Alison, I'm just going to go straight in because we're going to be pushing a little bit for time. But I would have to say that for animal breeders like myself, the last year has been one of the most exciting times in our careers because we've been told for the last 20 years that molecular technologies are just around the corner. And those of us who wanted to look around the corner, like Jerry, rolled up their sleeves and learned how to extract DNA and do their own genotype so they could play with these things. Other people like myself, who has never knowingly extracted any DNA, took advantage in the last 12 months of getting downloads. The first download I got, I think there were 50 million genotypes, and we started to work with that data to say just how good is that information to predict performance. So I want to tell you a little bit about where things are at. One of the questions you're probably asking is, you know, what's the value of this technology? And the value of the technology depends on a number of things. It depends on which traits it's available for, it depends on which breeds it will work in, and it will depend on how big that panel is. Of course, the other aspect of value is how much you're going to have to pay to get this. And I'm not going to talk about that. That's going to be an issue which is driven by technology, driven by panel size, and driven by the genomics companies. But obviously, they want to develop a product that has value to them and value to you. So they have to recoup all the costs they're doing of these discovery populations, but they also need to make something that that makes money for you. So Mike's already talked about phases, and I've indicated here that there are three phases. There's a training or discovery phase to work through these SNPs and see which ones are good. There's a validation phase to make sure that the ones you think are good really are good, and that's a little bit of an interesting task, and sometimes, as Mike indicated to you, things don't validate at all like you thought they did from your training analysis. And then third, there's a commercialization phase where the genomics companies need to decide what is it they're actually going to deliver, what size chip and for what traits, and where are they going to market it. And I'm not going to talk about the commercialization, but I'll touch on the first two aspects. So the training phase, as Mike has pointed out, requires thousands of animals with DNA samples, with individual information or with offspring information. The genotyping, $250 to $300 an animal, so over 1,000 animals, you're talking about pretty significant investments. And I understand Illumina sold something like 100,000 of those 50K chips the last year, so there's been an enormous investment of new money in genetic improvement of beef cattle and dairy cattle that hasn't occurred for years. And hopefully you'll be taking advantage of some of that and repaying the investment those companies made by buying these tests in the future, provided they give value to you. So what are the phenotyping options? There's basically two. The first of them is to say, well, what we should genotype are bulls which have reliable EPD information. So you can use existing EPD. It means you've got to get current and historical AI size, and that's a huge task. And Jerry's already indicated that he spent a lot of time on the phone and with his checkbook buying semen and putting together a repository. Great idea. Mike talked to you about needing, say, 7,000 animals to get a reasonably accurate prediction for a heritability of 0.3. One of the advantages of using EPDs, it's like using a trait with a higher heritability because, if you like, the heritability of a progeny mean is higher than the heritability of an individual performance. So you get more power by using AI sires. The problem with AI sires is you're limited to the EPDs that have existed for that breed association. So I've given a list there, and you all know what they are for your particular breed. That's what will be available if bulls in your breed are used for training. The principal data sets of AI bulls, I've indicated here that there are essentially two. There's a collection of something like 2,000 Angus bulls, which Jerry put together, which he talked to you about a minute ago, plus some other collections of Limousin and some other breeds that he's been working on. Plus the US Meat Animal Research Center has put together, with the breed associations, a set of 2,000 more recent AI bulls representing 16 breeds. And originally that was put together more as a validation population where predictions were going to be made from discoveries done at US Mark. And I think Mark Tallman might be talking about that particular population in one of the subcommittees here. The second phenotyping option is to collect individual phenotypes on the same animals that you're going to get 50K data on. And if you do that, it has the advantage that you can use non-seed stock animals, you can use steers, for instance. And there are a number of different data sets around, and I'm sure I don't have an exhaustive list of them, but I'll just report some of the ones that I'm aware of. There's a reproduction data set which was funded by the USDA, led by Milt Thomas at New Mexico, and that's principally a Brangus heifer data set, 800 Brangus heifers from Camp Cooley, where he has a lot of growth and reproductive characteristics. In addition, there's been collection of a lot of DNA and reproductive phenotypes from the Rex Ranch, and John Pollock and Matt Spangler have been involved in the collection of that data, so that will be a useful repository for somebody in the future to do genomic analyses on fertility. There's a beef healthfulness data set, which is sometimes referred to as healthy beef. It was a project that was turned down by the USDA for funding. It was turned down by the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, and it was picked up by Pfizer Animal Genetics. It was led by Jim Reese at Iowa State University. Involves about 2,200 Angus animals, some of which came from Jack Cowley's herd. I know Jack is here in the audience, and some of his animals were used in that project, as were some from Don Smith and from Iowa State. You can't underestimate how much work it is to actually collect data on these animals and while they're alive, and then when they're going through the feedlot, and make sure you get DNA and samples. And Alison Van Enenen did a lot of work at Harris Ranch collecting some of those data. Oklahoma State is involved, doing a lot of meat trait and taste panel work, and then there's growth, carcass, meat traits, fatty acid compositions, vitamin and mineral concentrations as well being analysed. And there was a paper at the Genetic Prediction Workshop earlier this year that provides more detail about that experiment if anybody's interested. There's also a feedlot health data set facilitated by the consortium, following along the idea from the Healthy Beef Project, and Pfizer took up that particular study as well. It's led by Mark Enns from Colorado State and involves almost 3,000 Angus steers from the Rex Ranch, which have been fed out in Lamar, Colorado. And in that particular study, feedlot growth and performance is of interest, but so is anything to do with sickness. So visual indication of sickness, BVD, lung lesions, how many times an animal was treated were of interest. And also, there was some thought that the susceptibility to stress might be related to how often animals got sick. So Bob Weber was involved in that trial, taking a number of measurements of flight speed and shoot score. So those are two data sets that are a little bit novel. There's also a very comprehensive data set from the US Meat Animal Research Center, where they are using the Cycle 7 animals, and of course you all are well aware of the kind of phenotypes that have been collected on the germplasm evaluation studies over the years. A lot of traits, sadly it's in a Nebraska environment only, and it would be nice if we could have that same kind of study replicated perhaps somewhere in the fescue belt and somewhere in the hotter part of the country, but still tremendous data set and a good team of researchers collecting it. There's also a study at Texas A&M with some Angus Naluri F2s, which includes feed intake and a whole lot of temperament and behaviour data. There's also a number of other data sets that are probably more short-term studies for RFI or feed intake studies, and I've just mentioned a few of those studies there. Probably all these studies are a little bit too small. They probably need to be about an order of magnitude larger than they are if we're going to find good things for residual feed intake, because it's not a clean trait. What we've discovered doing these kind of analyses in dairy cattle in particular, because we're doing it a little bit longer, is that if you study a trait like protein in the milk, it's hard to find much, because protein is a mixture of many, many different kinds of protein, probably something like 200 different proteins in milk. But if you look at one of those proteins, then you start finding big effects. So if you can dissect a trait into a cleaner, simpler trait, you get much better results than you look at a composite trait. And traits like residual feed intake, it's a real composite trait because it's got everything about feed intake, it's got predictions about body weight, it's got predictions about composition. So if there are big genes affecting composition, if there are big genes affecting body weight, if there are big genes affecting voluntary intake, all those things are going to be mixed up and make it harder to find things. The scope of the training, so in summary for that, many breeds are represented, but they're principally Angus. And if you've got Bos Indicus cross cattle, and I know there are a lot in the US that do, you're pretty poorly represented in these studies. The national environments are represented for EPDs because wherever registered cattle are being run, those environments are represented. Unfortunately, the study of phenotypes, you're looking at local environments. And if your environment is not like the local environment, then maybe the results are not going to work so well. Carcass traits are pretty well represented. Disease and fertility traits are probably still pretty weakly represented. What's the nature of the training analyses that are going to be done to these studies? Well, basically, there's two kinds. There's least squares types of analyses where you look at one SNP or two SNPs or sets of SNPs. We know, as Jerry pointed out, there are some problems. They tend to overestimate the effects. They give you effects that are biased upwards unless your experiment is very powerful. And you can't use all the SNPs at once with those analyses. There's another raft of methods based on Bayesian technology, and in those approaches we can fit all of the SNPs at once, and we can repeatedly test models with different subsets of the SNPs. And I'll tell you a little bit more about those later. And just to illustrate the point that Mike made, that we haven't come to a consensus on the methodology, I used the word genomic EPD to refer to the SNP prediction of a chromosome fragment, which he called an MBV, rather than after it was joined in with the phenotypic information. So validation, you've already heard that almost always you can find SNPs that spuriously fit the data well. So you actually learn very little about how good your analysis is when you look at the results from the actual discovery. So many of you will be aware of all of these articles that come out in the paper where some university has made an incredible discovery that will revolutionise the beef cattle industry, and then you never hear of that test again. That's just an example of that, where the researcher got all a bit excited. They had a eureka moment based on their discovery population without first checking that it worked somewhere else. So training and validation, they're both important, but validation can be done together with training. And I'll just point out what we have been doing with many of our data sets, including the data set with the 1,700 or so Angus bulls that Jerry talked about. So if we have something like 1,700 bulls, we actually don't do the training analysis with the EPDs because the EPDs include parent average information, and all of the offspring have that same parent average information. We try to get a cleaner measure, which is known as a deregressed proof. So basically we try to get back to what the progeny mean would have been that went into that EPD. And when we do that, we find that if we had 1,700 bulls with EPDs, maybe we've only got 1,500 that have got real data. The others just had parent average. So we split the data into, say, three groups. So there might be about 500 bulls in group one, about 500 in group two, and about 500 in group three. And Mike pointed out that you don't want to do this randomly. What we have tended to do, we've actually separated them a number of different ways, but we've tended to separate them so that no paternal grandsire, no father of the bulls, has sons in more than one of the groups. Okay, so each AI, the sire of the AI bull, his brothers are all in the same group. Because if you put the brothers in the validation set, you get really good validation results. And we don't want to get good validation results and then have it tested on a new population and not work so well. We'd rather get the worst possible validation results when we're trying to work out how well these things work. So, of course, we want to be greedy, we want to use everybody for validation, so we can then train on group 1 and group 3 and predict the missing group 2, and we can train on group 1 and group 2 and predict the missing group 3. So at the end of this process, every bull has been in 2 training analyses and in 1 validation analysis. And we can work out what the correlation was for what I've called that validation in group 1. We can work out in group 2 and group 3. We can pool it over everything. So, of course, what you want to know is how well does this work? So I'll share you a little bit of those results. So this is where we're training in these Angus AI bulls and validating in the Angus AI bulls. And if we look at back fat with the data set split those 3 ways, the correlations I'm getting in each of those 3 subsets are around about 0.7, and the pooled correlation across all of the 1,500 to 1,700 bulls around about 0.7. So that's the correlation between the genomic prediction of how good they are based only on their SNP genotypes and how they actually performed with progeny based on the American Angus Association data set. So 0.7, roughly the correlation. So if you square that, you're talking about around 50% of the variation being captured by the 50K SNP data for back fat. But we're not all interested just in back fat. So there is a set of some of the other traits that we've done on this data set. Calving ease direct, calving ease maternal, marbling, ribeye area, scrotal circumference, weaning weight direct effect, and yearling weight. So if you look down that overall column on the right, you'll see the best predictions are around about 0.7, correlations of 0.7 for marbling and back fat, and the poorest correlations are a little better than 0.5. And of course, if the correlation is 0.5, if you square that, it's accounting for 25% of the variation. Whereas if it's 0.7, it's accounting for 50% of the variation. So in summary, the 50K predictions, they give us correlations between 0.5 and 0.7. They account for between 25 to 50% of the genetic variance. Now that might not mean that much to you. You're probably used to BIF accuracies and not used to things like proportion of variation. So what I've indicated there is that if we had a trait with a heritability of 25%, then having a 50% of the variation accounted for would be like having a progeny test with 15 offspring. Okay? So the best predictions we're getting out of a 50K SNP test is as if you had observed the performance of 15 offspring of that bull in a well-managed progeny test when all of the offspring were run together. The poorest predictions we're having is around about 5 to 6 offspring in a progeny test. And that's about equivalent to having 1 observation on the individual for that trait. Okay, so that gives you an idea. It's about, the worst ones are like having 1 observation on the individual or about 5 or 6 progeny. The best ones are like having 15 progeny. So if those of you who thought that genomic prediction was going to give you really accurate breeding values, like having a progeny test with 1,000 animals, then I'm sorry, but you've been misled over the years. That's not what's happening. This is like progeny test information, but it's occurring at a young age. So we're getting much more accuracy at a young age, but we're not getting perfect accuracy, at least not yet. These correlations of 0.7 are pretty similar to the genomic predictions that are being achieved in dairy cattle. You will hear some numbers that are higher than 0.7, but mostly that's after they've blended the parent average information from the animal model blood programs back into their genomic predictions. So pretty similar to what is being seen in dairy cattle. Okay, so not as highly accurate as a well-designed and managed progeny test with lots of offspring, but a whole lot cheaper and a whole lot faster. Okay. So a crossbreed prediction, we're all interested in a crossbreed prediction. What we want to know is how well would these predictions work in some other breed, perhaps a Hereford or a Simmental or whatever your particular breed might be. And we know that those predictions won't be as accurate for a number of reasons. For one thing, some of these gene effects might be dominant and the gene frequency might be different in the other breed. For another thing, some of these gene effects might be epistatic, so they might interact, and the gene frequency of the epistatic gene might be different. We also might have problems that we have not very reliably predicted the effect of the small genes, and we also have a problem that the linkage disequilibrium between the real gene and the marker we're using might be less than adequate. So all of those things could make it perform more poorly in another data set. So ideally what I would like to have shared with you would be the results from a couple of thousand AI bulls from some other breed, where we did a cross-validation of both directions. I can't do that because we don't have that data. But what I can do is do some simulation we've done, and this is simulation where we've used actual 50K genotypes to simulate at least a sort of an indicative level of how well these things might work across breed. So the data sets we've had, one of them is a multi-breed population where animals were sired by one of eight different breeds, and I show you there what those breeds are. The other population is a purebred population of Angus, about 1,000 animals in each population. So rather than simulating effective population sizes and simulating genes and simulating linkage disequilibrium, we've said we've got real 50K data on these animals. Let's imagine some of those SNPs were real genes and see how good a job we could have done. So this just shows you the simulation up on top, that those little boxes represent the 50,000 different markers that are on the panel, and the ones I've indicated in blue are ones that we've randomly chosen and assumed to be a real gene. And we randomly chose 50, 100, 250 or 500 to be a real gene, and we sampled the effect of each of those genes from a normal distribution. So some of them were big and some of them were small. And then we added up the effect of each of those genes, so we assumed these genes were all additive, to get a EPD, if you like, for the individual. And then we added in a non-genetic residual part with the same variance as the genetic part. So this was equivalent to having a heritability of 50%. And then we said, what kind of marker panel might we use to analyze this data? So we made one marker panel where we said, what would happen if we had a panel that just had the real genes on it? So the blue squares there was the panel of the real genes. We said in real life you're not going to have the real genes, but what you hope to have is a marker that's in high linkage disequilibrium with the real gene. So for each real gene we had, we went through the 50K panel and found the best marker that indicated that, the one with the highest correlation or highest linkage disequilibrium with that real gene. And so we made a panel of those. So that would be like some futuristic panel that only has good genes on it. And then we also had a panel that had all the 50,000 markers on it, but didn't have the real genes on it. The equation down the bottom is how we did our Bayesian analysis. And basically, for those of you that are more technically interested, we fit a covariate, which has the genotype for each particular animal, the number of SNP alleles it has, number of ALLs it has, say. We estimate the effect of that covariate for each of the 50,000 SNPs, and to do that we fit it as a random effect. And then we have this other little component there on the equation, that little delta. And that little delta is what we use in our Bayesian variable analysis, where that delta is either 0 or 1. So when it's 1, that SNP is in the model. When it's 0, that SNP is not in the model. So rather than necessarily fitting all 50,000 at once, we do something quite similar to the Bayes B that Mike talked about, where we might just fit 10% of them or 1% of them in the model. And then we go through all 50,000 and say, would we have a better model if we dropped out one of the SNPs that's in there now, which means changed its delta from 1 to 0, or would we have a better model if we put a SNP that's not in the model into the model? So we ask that question 50,000 times of each SNP, and that's what we call one chain, and then we repeat that about 50,000 times. So what we do over a period of 2 or 3 hours is basically compare thousands and thousands of different models with subsets of these SNPs to try and get ones that fit better. And that's how we computed the results I showed you before. So if we had just 50 real genes on this chip, and I used the panel that had the real genes on it, the 50 real genes on it, then the correlation I get, if I do my discovery in one population and predict in the other, is something like 0.95, 0.96. So if at some point in the future we could ever have a panel with the real genes on it, we do an incredibly good job of predicting performance, even with a population as low as 1,000 animals. And if there wasn't dominance in epistasis, it would work very well across breeds. What happens if we add to the panel not just the real gene, but we add the SNP that is in high linkage disequilibrium? So now we've gone to a panel which has 100 markers on it, the 50 real genes and the 50 that are highly correlated. And so that's the second row in your table, and you see our prediction goes down a little bit because we have trouble telling the difference between the real gene and the marker that looks very like the real gene. But it really doesn't matter too much when we make a mistake, because either of them work pretty well in the other population. If we go to a 50K panel that includes the real gene, then we take a little bit more of a drop. We're dropping down to around about a correlation of 0.8, because now we're making more mistakes. We're making more type 1 errors, if you're into statistical jargon. So it's harder to distinguish the real genes from all of the markers that pick up some of their signal. But still, these are pretty good correlations going across breed. So if we could have a SNP panel that had markers that were really good surrogates of the real gene, we could do really well predicting across breed. But what happens if we have to deal with the 50K panel that we have at the moment? Well, I guess the fourth row there is if we had just the best markers. So if I choose the best 50 markers off the panel, the correlation drops down to round about 0.5 to 0.6. So that tells you that the best markers on the panel just are simply not good enough. There's not enough linkage disequilibrium on the 50K panel to have a good surrogate for every gene. Probably of those 50 QTL, probably about 20 to 25 of them we had a really good marker for, but 10 or 15 of them we had no very good markers for. So what we need is a denser panel with more markers to make sure we can pick up more of those genes. And if we go to the last line, which is real life, where we've got 50,000 markers on it, none of them are the real causative QTL, and we have to try and sort out what's going on, then the correlation drops to round about 0.4. So 0.4, you square that, you're talking about accounting for 16% of the variance. What happens if there's more than 50 QTL? Mike talked a bit about how many QTL there might be and indicated that maybe there are lots of them and maybe they're smaller. If we had 100 rather than 50, then the average size of each of those SNPs is smaller because there's more of them. And since they're smaller, we make more errors. We've got more of them to predict and their size is smaller, we make more errors and our correlation goes down. And if it goes on up to 250 or 500 QTL, then it drops right down to a correlation of 0.2 to 0.3. So that would be, if you square that, 4% to 9% of the variance we would be accounting for. So that's less information than you would have by having one observation on the individual, a lot less. So pretty sobering results for a crossbreed evaluation. So if you're in the audience and you don't have Angus cattle, I'd be getting a little bit worried about what might be delivered to you in the near future, because most of those training populations are dominated by Angus animals. And I would reiterate the comment that Jerry made, that you need some DNA repositories. You need to be pulling out of your semen tanks some semen and making it available to the researchers so they can use it for training and validation, because these results are not going to be just dropped on you from Angus studies, at least not with the current 50K panel. So 50K across breed prediction, current prospects are not promising. Better results will be achievable with a higher density panel because it will have more LD. And I don't know what the number is, but we probably need at least 500k, and if we get 700 to a million, that would be even better. More animals in the training analyses will also help the results. We know that we'll get a little bit more if we had 2,000 than if we had 1,000 animals. And then in real life, of course, we may have dominance in epistasis, so that might reduce the predictions that I showed you here relative to the situation where we've just got additive effects. So the other question you want to know is how well do these predictions work if you have a smaller panel than the 50K panel? So we know the 50K panel works well within breed, getting good correlations. What happens if you use lesser markers? And again, we did this by doing some Bayesian analyses. We ran all 50,000 markers, and then we ran all 50,000 markers on two of the groups of data, and then we picked out of those the best 600, the ones that had a higher probability, the ones whose delta value was one more often. So we might have only been fitting, say, 5% of the SNPs in the model, but a good SNP might have been in the model 80% of the time. So we'd say that's one we want to put on our panel. So we chose 600 markers, so based on model frequency and based on covering the whole genome. And then we readed our training analysis on that 600, and then we predicted how good the missing group was based on those 600 markers. And there's the result for back fat. So from 50,000, whereas overall we'd got 0.69 with 50,000 effects, the best 600 markers getting this genomic coverage dropped to 0.63. So a little bit of a drop, but nothing too horrendous. So here are the results for all the rest of the traits I showed you before. So the middle column is the correlation we got across all of those groups with 50K. The right-hand column is what happened when we only used 600. And what you'll notice is for one or two traits like calving ease, we actually did just as well with 600, maybe even a little bit better than we did with all 50,000. For most of the other traits, we took a drop, but actually not very much. So yearling weight, we had 0.56. We only dropped to 0.55 when we dropped to 600 markers. So these results suggest that at least in Angus kind of populations, a marker panel of, say, 600 markers chosen for a particular trait might be almost as good as having 50,000 of them. If we had a 500K panel, we could probably do a better job of finding 600 SNPs than we could if we had a 50K panel. But unfortunately, 600 markers are, for technological reasons, not a particular cheap option. If we had eight traits, we'd need about 5,000 markers. A cheaper option is to try and fit all these SNPs onto a 384 panel. So if you wanted a 384 SNP panel that did several traits, you can probably only choose about 100 SNPs for each trait, for 3 to 4 key traits. And these are the results. This is probably one of the rows that Jerry had in his data, showing you what happens for marbling as we go from a panel of 50 to 100 to 150 to 200. Then we progressively get higher predictions. And then if we go to a set of 384 that are chosen across several traits, there's the opportunity not just to use the 100 chosen for your trait, but to use any of the other ones that might be useful. And that puts the correlation up, and this is in an independent population, so this has nothing to do with training populations. This is a totally separate validation population of those 698 steers. We're getting correlations around about 0.5 for marbling and a little over 0.4 for ribeye area. You can also validate it by going out and getting some new bulls. So Jerry and Mariel got another 270 AI bulls that weren't available for the training analysis, and this just shows you how well that 384 panel worked for those traits there compared to the validation I'd done where I'd done three-way splits of the data. So what you'll see in the last column there is with a 384 panel chosen across multiple traits, you can get correlations for marbling as high as 0.6. So that's accounting for more than a third of the variation. The poorest correlation there was for back fat and yearling weight, but I don't think either of those traits were used in the selection of SNPs that went on the 384 panel, and that's why they took a bigger drop. Because remember, this 384 panel is across all traits. So, in summary, a number of breeds being analysed, particularly in the Cycle 7 data at Clay Centre, but most of the analyses at the moment are being done with Angus. Traits, mostly growth and carcass. Because of the EPDs, you're going to get all of the EPD traits done when AI sires use. A lot of carcass data, and of course there's a lot of interest in both the feedlot health and the healthfulness traits that might come out of the Pfizer study. Problem with the environments is most of them are not going to be your environment. They're going to be somebody else's environment, and we still don't know anything about how well these predictions will be in the context of genotype environment interaction. The 50K panels applied within breed are going to be like measuring 5 to 15 progeny on the animal at the moment you pay for that test and get the genotypic results back. The 50K across breed panel would be like having at best one individual record or five progeny. At worst, it might be as low as being totally uninformative. The reduced panel within breed varies, and it could be up to being almost as good as the 50 panel. It really depends on how many markers are on the particular panel and whether the trait you're particularly interested in is used to produce that reduced panel. So the reduced panels is really going to be a marketing decision that needs to be made by the genomics companies. So just want to acknowledge some of the co-workers and people that made all this possible. Thanks.